This interview for the Veterans History Project is being done on Anna Spillman
Atterbury
on April the 2nd, 2007. Interviewers are Ruth Stewart and Trish Martin. This is done in San Antonio, Texas. And tell us, as we start out, about your early life, where you were born, what your life was like as a girl growing up.
I was born in West Feliciana Parish, Louisiana. I lived in the country, and I was the oldest of six children. I walked to school the first 3 years over a mile and a half on muddy roads, and I had to cross two streams to get to school. Well, when I finally got to the fifth grade, we were lucky. We got a school bus and went into town. See, I'm a child of the Depression. We didn't have a lot, believe me. And I went through, our school was small, really. When I graduated from high school, I think there was all of about 20 students. Our parents worked hard, but they didn't have a lot of money back in the 30s. And when I finished high school, there were not very many things open to me. My family were not able to send me to college because there were five children behind me to be fed. I had about two choices. I could stay with relatives in the city and go to business college, or I could go into nurses training. And you know, when you stop and think how much education costs these days, my parents borrowed $50 from the bank to pay my tuition into nursing school. And they struggled to give me $1 a month allowance. And that had to buy my toothpaste and all the things that I have. And now when I think how we throw money away, I have more now. Mm-hmm. And when I finished nurses training, I guess it was just before I finished with Pearl Harbor. I was working nights and I turned on my little radio and I couldn't understand why all I was getting was all this static stuff. And I walked out in the hall and one of the girls said something about, do you know that they bombed Pearl Harbor today? And I remember saying, where is Pearl Harbor? I really didn't know. Then I began to really know because I had a brother there at the time in the Navy, but his ship wasn't hit. And about that time, I guess everybody may think about going in the service. Everywhere you looked, men were in uniform. Everybody was joining the military, some branch of it. So when I finished nurses training and passed state board, Myrtle Carpenter and I both went in the Army together. And we had our choices. We looked at it, and we picked the one that was the farthest from home, El Paso, Texas, Fort Bliss.
Why did you choose the Army?
My father had been in the Army, and I had a brother that was already in the Navy because he was only 13 months younger than I was, and there was no money for him to go to college, so he went in the Navy. And then I had another brother who was in the Marine Corps. Well, he had run away from home when he was 16 and had joined the Marine Corps right after the one went in the Navy. So I decided to go in the Army. And this was really something. We got to El Paso. There was a raging sandstorm. Somebody met us at the train. And we were taken to the chief nurse's office. And instead of being a shy kid and keeping my mouth shut, I knew you could get transfers. You know, I'd heard about people transfers. My second thing to her was, when can I get a transfer? I want to leave this place. I later knew her socially, and she always laughed about that. Anyway, I got assigned there, and they had two places. Then they had old William Beaumont, which was permanent. But they had opened this cantonment-type hospital that had these wooden ramps and wooden chutes off of them. And that was the station hospital at Fort Bliss. And the nicest thing, across the fence, from the hospital was Biggs Air Force Base. They had a nice bunch of young officers over there. And so we enjoyed that too. So I began to think about going overseas. So I signed up for a hospital ship. And several months went by, didn't hear anything on it. Then all of a sudden, 10 of us were sent to Fort Sam Houston, the 56th Evacuation Hospital, the Baylor Unit of Dallas. Didn't have enough nurses. They had to have 52 nurses in this hospital group, the 56th Evac. They sent 10 of us from Fort Bliss, 10 of us from Camp Chaffee, Arkansas, and 3 from Fort Lee, Louisiana, to complete the 56th Evac. Well, they were all nice, but you got to remember when we first went over, those were Baylor doctors and those were Baylor nurses. They were in charge of the operating room, the admission room, and what have you. But it was interesting.
Were they arrogant about it?
No, I guess at the time, you know, we're young, you know, you're young, you're 22, 23 years old, and you're thinking, ha, if you're not a Baylor graduate, you're never going to get anywhere here. But when we left, that's where we learned to drill at Fort Sam Houston. And you know, you would be surprised. We poor girls, your left from your right. We marched on that open field out there. They taught us how to march. Then we went on a train, and it was a long train ride to New York. It must have taken us, I know, at least 10 days. And we arrived in the middle of the night up in New York. It was north of New York City. I'm trying to remember the name of the place. Cold, it was freezing cold. And that's when we really found out what it was like to rough it. They gave us 2 old wool blankets. These buildings were temporary. You could see the cracks. Even though it was 4 o'clock in the morning, you could see daylight from the lights in the place. And it was just this spring on this metal bed. So put the blanket down there. And we two were together still. We decided to pool the 2 blankets under us. And we slept together on the cot and put the 2 wool blankets on top of us. Well, I guess we stayed there about 10 days till they gave us, checked all our immunization and everything. And then we got on this ship. And it was a luxury liner that had been used in the Pacific between San Francisco and Hawaii. But it was wall-to-wall people on there. We were in a room that would have been a single room, maybe a couple, you know, during peacetime. There were 16 of us in there. We were stacked like that. But, you know, we were lucky. The men in the ballroom, the whole thing was a long canvas, and they had to go like this to get to where they
laid. Was this a hospital ship or transport?
No, this was a transport. This Tuskegee Aviators, you know, from Alabama, the mm-hmm. black pilots, mm-hmm. they were also on that ship. And we traveled alone. We didn't do anything. We didn't do any work or anything like that. There was barely room to move. And we went into Casablanca. And that's where we first started working. It wasn't very hard there because, you know, the troops had moved on ahead. And then we started moving. And as the battles would move on, we would set up a hospital. We took care of casualties. We took care of the American casualties, British casualties, any Allied casualties. And finally, we ended up in Bizerte, Africa, which was in Tunisia. And we had a hospital there. It was an old French barracks, and I was in the operating room there. And so a lot of our patients then were not really casualties until just before the invasion of Sicily and Italy. And the Germans started flying over at night, and they would bomb the harbor. Well, then we would get a lot of patients then. And that was my first chance where I found out you just didn't work in the daytime. We worked until we took care of all the casualties, which could be 24 hours in the operating room. Later on, we modified that because we weren't holding up very well. And then, after they finally secured Sicily and everything, we went in on the invasion of Italy, and we landed at Salerno. And it was too shallow to get in where we landed, so they let us off in the water. And of course, you know, you got a full pack on. And we didn't have nice uniforms then because, see, they didn't know what to send nurses over with then. And we bought men's pants and men's stuff, and it was all big on you, you know. And the water was just weighing me down. I'll never forget, I fell on my face. I'm in the water, and some sergeant comes behind me, just stands me up. And we set up a hospital, I guess, there it was, north of Naples. And we'd move with the troops. Our hospitals were not in buildings. We were in tents. And we ended up that winter on the Cascina front.
Just before we go on, tell us about setting up a hospital. Say you would follow the invasion as it moved mm-hmm. on, and you would set up, you nurses and doctors would set up a hospital in a tent. You would put up a tent. Go on, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the hospital was all tents. We weren't in buildings there. And, of course, we had men who would put the tents up. Like the operating room, we had one large tent, one long tent. And then we had a second tent where all of our supplies were put together and everything. Where we lived were called wall tents. Two people would occupy them. Now, the men had larger tents where more men were, but the officers and nurses were in two wall tents. And we were on dirt floor. We did not have flooring. We were on the ground. But we still managed to keep everything sterile. We had autoclaves, you know. We had a motor out there. They had set up a motor, and we had an autoclave there where we'd sterilize everything. And I think right now in civilian hospitals, you probably have more infections than we did. And we were an evacuation hospital. So many of our surgeries were completed back at station or general hospitals. Like on amputations, we did guillotines. The repairs and the making of the flaps and everything were done back at stations, generals. See, we had no helicopters then.
Would they go on by train?
Sometimes by train, but most of the time by ambulances or trucks if they could sit up. And sometimes from the general hospitals, and they would wait for hospital ships or else. I think they did transport, some air transports. And I guess we stayed on that, because that was horrible, that Cascina front. The Germans were up in the monastery. We stayed there the whole winter, and it was thick black mud, and they had to make pack dirt to where we had pathways, because you step out and that stuff, you'd go up to your knees in it. It's black mud and cold and wet. It was just very cold and wet. And we got casualties because, see, they were trying to take that Cascina hill from the Germans, and so there were casualties. We had casualties all winter. And of course, when the operating room would slow down, then we'd go out, some of us would have to go out of the wards because we had a lot of patients with pneumonia and colds and that sort of stuff. Well, then we were pulled back and went to Anzio. And we went all the way back to Naples, and we sailed out of there.
When was that then?
That was in 1943, I guess. I don't know. 44, I guess we were in Anzio. I've forgotten the dates. Anyway, we spent 78 days on Anzio. We set up, all the hospitals were together, the 90, the 5060 VAC, the 9030 VAC, the 9050 VAC, the 16th Field was right behind us. And the Germans were up on the mountain, and they had those big old guns they would pull out and they would shoot. When you'd hear them go boom, you'd listen for the whistle. And if you heard the whistle, you knew it was going to the harbor. If you didn't hear the whistle, you'd feel like ducking. because they would drop shells in our hospital. We had people that were killed. They also bombed our hospitals. They knocked out the 95th in the broad daylight one afternoon at 3 o'clock. And, you know, you would be scrubbed up in surgery. And even if they weren't bombing you, if we were shelling these planes, all this flak would fall. You'd be in the operating room and these big old metal flak would come through the canvas. And, you know, you couldn't run off or anything. I mean, you had to stay in there. But I guess now when I look back on it, it was almost primitive medicine, but yet it was very good surgery we did. And we gave the patients very good care. Mm-hmm. You know, even out on the wards, the friends who worked in the medical tents, the patients all got their medications on time. And I thought we did pretty good. And then after we came back from Anzio, we left everything. When a new hospital came in and replaced us, we had to leave all of our equipment behind. We have to leave all of our setup. And we came back to Italy and we took over all of their equipment and what they had left behind.
Why was this followed up? I mean, was the next hospital that came in to follow you or the next group to take over, were they a different kind of care?
No.
Or just to move them?
No, they,
or give you some relief?
They decided that we all were getting pretty battle weary and they replaced us. And we went there. And then they had to push through to Rome. And that moved pretty fast. And we were in a building. We set up in a building, believe it or not, in Rome. It might have been bombed out in the middle and we had to go on around. But we actually were inside. We had a hospital inside of a building. And that was a treat. And I stayed with the 56th then until they were south of south of Piombino, and then I came all the way back. I was transferred out of the unit with another girl. She was an anesthetist, and we went to France with the 10th Field. And the 10th Field worked they worked different than the evac hospital. There was like six of us and three doctors and corpsmen. We were divided into three different groups. The chief nurse of the commando, I never saw them, were about twice. They were way back behind us somewhere in the headquarters. And with the field hospital, you took care of the casualties. And if they were transportable, you sent them on back. If your patients, they move fast in southern France. If you had a patient that was non-transportable, they left a nurse, a doctor, two corpsmen, and a truck driver behind with the patients. Either they passed on and you notified grave registration to pick them up, or they were finally able to transport. Then we would catch up with the group we were with again.
But how would you travel then? You
had to travel in that truck.
You had a truck.
See, we stayed all in this one big truck.
The truck driver was your transport methodology. Mm-hmm.
And then we'd catch up with our unit again. But I didn't, our surgery there and our care there was a lot different than 56, because it was strictly taking care of patients who were really bad. And most of those died. Now you got a helicopter to pick them up. You know, you don't have it. I don't think they do that anymore. They got to. You can get hit in Iraq right now, and you could be at Brooks General, what, in 48 hours, 72 hours? That's the reason from Vietnam you have so many double and triple amputees that you saw through the years, because they could get hurt in Vietnam, and they could be out here at Brooks General in 48 hours. Because I know when my husband used to go to the pool for Fiscalera, that warm pool, There were a lot of the Vietnam fellas out there, amputees in the pool. And that's the reason so many of them live. World War II, many of them didn't live because they could not be evacuated back to the States as quickly, you know, to get the care they get now. I don't know, sometimes when you see the condition some of them are in, I don't know whether... I would not be saying that. That's on... I left the 10th Field when I became ill, and I came back to the States as a patient. And once I got a patient status, I went to a general hospital in the United States. At McKinney, Texas, Ashburn General. And I saw patients there that had been there for many years from World War II. I mean, they had been amputees, some of them. They were still patients there. Some of them had been hurt real bad. I had a ward there. I didn't work in the operating room. And I had a tendency to spoil my patients, especially the ones who had been, you know, hurt overseas during the war. I especially remembered one person. I've often wondered how he made it. He was a Mexican. His name was Torres. And he had been hurt in the South Pacific. And he was a master sergeant. He had to be good to have been a master sergeant then. And he had been badly injured, and he was very crippled. His leg was real short. And he'd get bouts of malaria. And I think some of the... He'd been around Ashburn a long time, and they had kind of classified him as a bad boy. And they couldn't understand why I spoiled him, and I didn't have any trouble with him. Well, I think I understood him. I really did. I understood him. I knew why he did some of the things he did. And sometimes he didn't want to get up in the morning. Well, he always made up his own bed. So I didn't insist that he get out of the bed in the morning. And I had a young female, they call them wats. She goes over there and rolls his bed up as high as she can roll it up. And all of a sudden, he throws something and it hits her. Well, my goodness, she's going to get him court-martialed, you know. I said, well, I told you, leave him alone. And they came down and asked a statement for me. And I guess I kind of fibbed. I said I didn't see anything sail and hit her. I just couldn't see having this man ruined. I mean, he'd been a patient there for what? They said he'd been there 4 years. And he had been in the military for about, oh, I guess 15 or 16 years. He needed that retirement. I just could not see him being ruined. I just couldn't.
Now, I'm not understanding. I thought you said you went back there as a patient.
Oh, no, I came back to Fitzsimmons as a patient.
Now, what's the order of that? Were you at Fitzsimmons after?
When I left overseas, I came back as a patient. I was on a hospital train coming down through France. I was on a hospital ship, and I was on a hospital train all the way across the United States to Fitzsimmons General Hospital.
That was before McKinney, then.
That was before McKinney.
Okay, I got all that wrong then.
You see, I guess I lapsed out of when I was a patient. New York City, the Army Nurse Corps had set up a hospital on Fifth Avenue, or in a building. Like you had, you know, the air evac, you had a station hospital, and all these people would come through and look there. You know, we had all these nurses here. We'd point out this stuff. And I was there, and they had triplets who were in the Army, the only triplets in the Army Nurse Corps. The last name was Chapelier, I think. I lost contact with them. And they were there, of course. And there were two that had been POWs in the Philippines, and they were there too. We were all, you know, showing around. Got good tickets to all the good shows and stuff, you know, they give us.
You mentioned that you had to go to New York in relation to the Avon Award. Tell us a little bit about that background on that Avon Award.
On the Avon Award, I got the Avon Award in Dallas, Texas at the Cotton Bowl. That's where they came and presented it to me. And they had a banquet at the Adolphus, and the mayor of Dallas crowned me with the Stetson, only I never got the Stetson. Somebody in Texas gave me the belt, had the belt, the boots, which I never got. I didn't pursue it, but I never did get them. And then while I was in New York with this, with the military hospital display there on Fifth Avenue, the Avon people, you know, also took me to places like Stark Club and to some of the other places for dinner, took Shores for lunch and that kind of, you know, they were getting their publicity out of it too. I don't mean to sound, but it's true, isn't it? I'm not flattered. And then the last thing, I guess the last time I had to go to New York, the military from Ashburn General, this was the last. They used to have a radio show called We the People. And I got sent there for We the People. Major Edith Ames met me there at the train, because she had arranged it all, because she was in the surgeon's office in Washington, D.C. And I was on We the People. And there was a lieutenant, he had, something had done. And Tyrone Power's wife, Annabella, was on the program too, you know. They always had to have a celebrity. And
but you were a celebrity.
I didn't feel like one. And, you know, and then I had to go another place while I was there. I can't even remember the playwright's name. He had to question you. Helen Hayes had a show where she would, they would have a show each week on that. But he didn't choose mine because he was very impatient with me. I think he wanted blood and gore, and I just wasn't about to do that, you know. Mm-hmm. He wanted to know what it felt like to see somebody's arm or leg amputated. What do? You throw it in a bucket? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wasn't a good subject. I wasn't a good subject. I
can understand that.
I just couldn't.
Now, the Avon Award, you said you had no idea how you were nominated for that.
I have no idea to this day. They say in this book, they've got a lot of them in there that got, they all got bonds. I got $1,000 bond. That was a big deal then. But you see, here's some more nurses. Here's some more women. They all got, they got $100 bonds.
Were they Avon Award or different?
They got Avon Awards, but they didn't get the plum. I got the plum.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So,
I don't know. They had a, I think they named Fanny Hurst and John Bowles. They had a committee that selected me out of this group. I have no idea how I ever got placed with this. To this day, I do not know. When I asked the Avon people, you know, it was like this. I really don't know whether they saw my picture, the paper, or what they saw.
Well, thank you very much for all this interesting information
that
you provided.
It's hard to remember back on some of this stuff, you know.
Well, I think you have a remarkable memory.
It's not easy to talk about this. You know, I don't like to talk about myself. Somebody told me once, who was it? I was with, it was Gary Cooper one time on some of the bond drive thing there. He said, fame is fleeting. Hang on to it while you can. And I thought, I don't want any fame. I just want to be my plain old self. See, this was taken when I came, they dressed me before I got off the hospital ship. You see, I was patient. And photographers came and took pictures of all we people that were coming in on the hospital ship. There were five, let's see, it was the wife who'd been hurt real bad, it was me. It was a pregnant USO worker, and it was a gold brick, corporal. And they had me dressed, I didn't even have a cap or anything, and they took this picture. And I've often wondered if this appeared in a paper or something, and if this is how they got it, I really don't know. Because I sent my dad the picture, I got the picture.
Mm-hmm.
Thing. But my mother wasn't impressed with all this stuff, you know. She's because she had three children in the military. She wasn't impressed.
Did your time in your work, your time in the military and your work with patients in the military and living with people in some of these cultures, did that make any kind of a difference in your life? That it carried on into your life from there on?
See, in Italy, I knew the Italians, but we weren't in close contact with them. You know, really, we weren't. They were poor. I guess Mussolini, you know, had not been very kind to some of them. Of course, they all hated Mussolini. When we come along, they all hated Mussolini. And in southern France, this is what I never could understand. In southern France, they had all these able-bodied men running around. Here we are fighting their war, and we have all these able-bodied men. They weren't in the French army. I know when I was in the 10th Field, I had been paid in a long time, and you know, we used to get these rations where they have the little coffee and cigarettes and all that stuff in there. And this friend and I, we didn't have any money. It was a lot of perfume to be bought around Grenoble. And I said, you know, we've got to have some money. And she said, well, where are we going to get it from? I said, I know. I said, listen, we put it all in a sack there. And I went in the barber shop, in this men's barber shop. I said, anybody got coffee, cigarettes? All these men popped out. And, you know, you only had about 4 cigarettes, each one of these little packs. We sold them for francs, and we had some money to buy some perfume. See, this was my ID thing, I guess, when I came in the military, from the War Department the other day. So it's very hard to really talk about any of this. When I stop and think, when I went overseas, there were 52 nurses, and I only know of 4 of us that are still living. I was next to the youngest. The youngest one lives up here in Wagner, Oklahoma. She retired from the VA. She went to Korea. She stayed in the Army a while. The one I finished school with, she is 89 years old. She moved back to Louisiana, she and her husband. They lived in Arizona a long time. And the other one, the last I heard, she lived up in Minnesota somewhere. She went to anesthesia school afterwards. She got married and had 4 children. And the rest of them have passed on. I mean, it's just like this picture that I showed you in this book here, where we were all sitting in a group on that British ammunition ship. Every last one of them are dead except me.
Have you been involved in any military or veterans organizations since you...
Only the WSL. I used to go all the time to WSL. One of my good friends, Madge Tigg, belonged there, and she was in the 56th with me. Now, she retired from the Army, and she died some years ago. And I guess after I moved over here and Madge died, I quit going to WSL. Because we used to always meet together. Mm-hmm. And she's buried out at Fort Sam. But now she did retire from the Army.
Well, we'll wind up this tape now, but we really do appreciate all that you have gone ahead and discussed all those.